Hey y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Rock it, rock, rock, rock it. Get down. Alright, y'all, welcome back. I got Jason on the phone. Jason Leopold, now writing for Al Jazeera, America.AlJazeera.com, I think it is. Where the hell is this article? Holy journalism, Batman. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me back on.
Very happy to have you here. Wow, tell the people about this great scoop you got. Where'd you get it?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say that.
Okay. But this is not a Freedom of Information Act thing. This is, you were leaked, correct?
Yes.
All of Abu Zubaydah's journals going back to the early 1990s, the whole kit and caboodle.
His six volumes of diaries that he wrote between 1990 and 8 days before his capture in March of 2002. And Abu Zubaydah, in case people are not completely aware of who he is the first so-called high-value detainee captured after 9/11. He is the one who the torture memo written by John Yoo was written specifically for. He is mentioned in the infamous presidential daily brief of August 2001, warning George W. Bush, quote, bin Laden determined to strike U.S. He is also tied to dozens of other Guantanamo prisoners, and their detention is basically linked to the fact that they were, you know, associates, alleged associates of Zubaydah. So these are incredibly important documents. I will say that I did actually file a Freedom of Information Act, Scott, for these diaries 2 years ago, and as recently as 2 months ago. And I filed that with the Department of Defense because these documents, and I should say that I have the English, the government's translations of the Arabic.
But unredacted, correct?
Completely unredacted. And the government or the Department of Defense denied my request for the diaries, and they said that if they were released to me, it would potentially jeopardize or his potential charges before military commission, and the Justice Department just simply denied turning them over. But these diaries are so important because it is more or less the bulk of the evidence that the government has against him in whatever their case is. And these diaries have been used to build a psychological profile of him, to exploit his fears. It's important as well because he tells this unbelievable, compelling story, Scott, certainly about the events leading up to 9/11 and the aftermath following the U.S. invasion. But going back even further, he talks about the role of jihadists, of mujahideen, in Afghanistan, which was supported by the U.S. At one time, and his involvement with these groups and his fight on the front lines there, and so he's really present at the rise of Al-Qaeda, which he talks about, the arrival of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which he also talks about, and it's just a fascinating look at this complex figure that he turned out to be. It's amazing, you know, insight.
Mm-hmm. All right, now I want to get into as much of that as we can, but a couple of notes here. First of all, what is your confidence in the translation here, in the documents that this is? Are you certain, for example, that this is a product prepared by lower CIA people for their higher-ups, that they would have every reason to get it as right as they could kind of thing, as compared to some story they're selling you?
Yeah, I mean, I did check on the authenticity of it, and, you know, his lawyers are even, you know, confident with regard to that as well.
Okay.
And let me just say that there have been many claims made about Abu Zubaydah. Mm-hmm. Over the years, about who he is, what his role is, and it's pretty clear that there's a chunk of these diaries that would not make the U.S. look very good, particularly, you know, what we've learned later on. So,
Because I wanted to ask you about the narrative that exists in some places anyway, and. Well, I'll leave the footnotes out because I don't want to get it wrong who wrote what. But more or less, I'm under the impression, I guess I should say, that the CIA was torturing this guy or they wanted to. The FBI was questioning him and they were getting somewhere. And then the CIA took him away and tortured him, whatever. Bush used him over and over again in press conferences as the reason that we had to torture people. Like, man, there's this Zubaydah guy. We tortured him. And then he sang like a canary and we saved all your lives over and over again because of what he told us. And then, according to Ron Suskin, Bush got in a big fight with George Tenet because at some point George Tenet, the head of the CIA, came and said, actually, that's not right. And Bush got mad at him and said, well, I already said he was important, so now you're going to make me lose face. Oh, and then part of that, too, was that the FBI said that the CIA is crazy if they think that this guy's the big kingpin because he's crazy. If you look at his diaries, he's obviously a madman and couldn't possibly have been in charge of anything. But that's not the impression I'm getting from your journalism here. So,
no, it's absolutely wrong that, you know, that Dan Coleman, former FBI special agent, who basically put out that narrative and passed it along to Ron Suskind, who wrote the book The 1% Doctrine, basically, you know, stating that evidence of his insanity was his diaries. And the what was behind that was that, as Suskind wrote in his book, that Zubaydah wrote to these various versions of himself, called Hani 1, Hani 2, Hani 3. Hani is the nickname that his parents gave him. But Zubaydah makes it so clear, Scott, in these diaries, why he chose to speak to another version of himself. And he says that, I am writing to a 30-year-old version of myself because I don't have any friends, and I need someone to talk to. And then he adds that, I'm not schizophrenic. I'm not insane. I'm not a crazy person. You know, this is me paraphrasing here, for doing this. So he's stating that explicitly. You have to wonder, how could, you know, an FBI special agent attached to, you know, the CIA's Bin Laden unit would come away with reviewing the diaries believing that this person is, you know, quote, certifiable split personality. There's absolutely no way, Scott, that these, you know, that he is mentally unstable as the FBI claimed.
No, I get it. I mean, look, FBI agents think a lot of things, and almost none of them are ever correct about anything. So that, I can understand how that goes in the category. Even if the CIA are the bad guys in the story, that they're the ones torturing him, that doesn't mean that the FBI have a clue what they're talking about.
So yeah, I think
we
that
can
it
dispense
basically
with that. I'll let you get back to your story because you got a hell of a story to tell here. I just want to clarify a couple of those things to start is all.
Yeah, no, I think that's important because that's the narrative out there. So, excuse me, the first diary that I wrote about, this was the first installment. It's part of this series. You know, the diaries, the government translations are more than 800 pages. And, you know, the first one, he's a computer engineering student in India. He's attending college. He's very lonely. Zubaydah is grew up in Saudi Arabia. He's of Palestinian descent. Doesn't have many friends. He sits around at night listening to Chris DeBerg, the soft you know, soft FM rock tunes of Christa Berg, who is best known for the song "The Lady in Red." I don't know if you recall that, but you know, he says that, you know, his only friend is a cigarette, and you can get the sense that this is a person who's very depressed. He decides, at the urging of a friend, to one day go to Afghanistan for training. This was in January of 1991, and he gets to Afghanistan, and his plan was to, you know, go into this training camp and return to India, you know, to finish his studies. And keep in mind that, you know, at this time, basically anyone can enter this training camp called Khaldun Training Camp, which goes back to, you know, which was supported by the U.S. and goes back to, you know, the 80s when you know, the Mujahideen were, you know, fighting against the Soviets. But he gets there, and suddenly he's sort of embraced by, you know, all of these other, you know, Mujahideen, you know, they welcome him in, and it's an experience he has clearly not felt before. And so he makes this decision that he's going to give up everything and go to what he calls stay in what he calls the land of jihad, Afghanistan. And, you know, from there, you follow this unbelievable evolution of, you know, computer engineering student to student of jihad, you know, to a man who became this master forger, you know, forging documents, travel documents, passports, and, you know, encountering all of these infamous, you know, figures, including bin Laden, Mohammed Atef, you know, former military, the deceased military leader of Al-Qaeda. I mean, he names names, Scott. He writes down every name, alias at least, of everyone he has encountered. And, you know, you get such great insight, first of all, into the, you know, this growth of Al-Qaeda and the infighting between, you know, what Zubaydah wanted to do, which was what he called defensive jihad, and what, you know, bin Laden was promoting, which was offensive jihad, which is what he says. And there's, you know, a lot of infighting, and there's competition, you know, among these, you know, among these groups. And, you know, you just follow this story, which is, I mean, truly, it's very cinematic in a sense.
Yeah, well, and what a scoop. I mean, what an inside view. And now, so as far as Bush arguing with Tenet about how important the guy was, he was important, but he wasn't bin Laden's lieutenant, is basically, I think, the point you're saying. He was important in other ways.
That's right. I mean, there are many instances throughout his diary, Scott, because he was, you know, I'm not sure what facilitator exactly means, but he was in charge of a guest house in, you know, Peshawar, Pakistan, and he calls himself sort of an administrator. He was basically the, you know, he would more or less meet everyone who, you know, would before they went into the training camps, they'd stop off at this, you know, at this guest house. And the guest house was, you know, called House of Martyrs. And so he would more or less meet everyone. He'd write down their names, write down some stories about them. But because he, you know, was the sort of, you know, the person that everyone saw first, his name was, you know, mentioned often. And he would often say in his diaries that the Pakistani media, and this is going back, by the way, to the mid-90s, that they're continuously identifying him as, you know, bin Laden's, you know, closely linked with bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and he's next in line to run Al-Qaeda. And he says in his diaries, I don't know why they're saying this. Where are they getting this information from? I'm not even a member of Al-Qaeda. How could I become their leader? So, you know, you know, he's critiquing these, you know, these news reports, and the fact that he is mentioned in these news reports, I mean, you could tell that he kind of likes it. He kind of likes the attention, but at the same time, you know, he's taking, you know, various security precautions. So, you know, seeing that in his diaries, you have to, you know, you wonder, like, why and how did we get it so wrong?
I mean, you talk about how he's writing with an eye toward an audience, an imagined audience that will get their hands on this thing one day, in a sense, too. So maybe he's just building in a little deniability. Who the hell's Bin Laden? I don't know what you're talking about, kind of thing.
Sure, you know, I mean, but he does say at the same time, you know, in an early volume, you know, remind me to tell you one day about Bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda organization. Then he goes on to say that, I'm thinking of joining Al-Qaeda, and this is a thought I've had for about 8 months since I arrived at the Al-Farouq training camp. Hmm. So, you know, and he's also very vocal writing about, you know, how he fears that maybe these diaries will fall into the wrong hands and be used against him. So he is holding back, and that's much later on.
Oh, I see. But no, this is Zubeda Diary shed new light on Twin Towers and links to Bin Laden. America.aljazeera.com. And of course, Abu Zubeda being one of the big stars of the terror war, at least as it was portrayed by the Bush regime in the first, you know, few years after September 11th, still being held down at Guantanamo Bay, was waterboarded. I guess he was the one who was waterboarded three times.
Yeah.
And, or wait, how many times was he waterboarded?
Well,
it was probably Sheikh Mohammed was 187, right?
No, 83 times in a single month.
83, right, right.
But I also just want to point out, Scott, is that, you know, for people coming to this the first time, it would be, you know, first of all, these are very lengthy stories. So anyone that's taken the time to read it, thank you. But the first one, last week,
I really enjoyed it. I think it's really great journalism. I really hope that people do. And you know what? Sometimes you can just sit and read an article real quick, and sometimes you got to devote a little bit of time to it. But, man, this one is worth it. This is really something else that you got here.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that the first installment will sort of, you know, sort of sets it up to really sort of understand, you know, this character, this person, Abu Zubaydah. And so, you know, reading that first before going into this one today, which sort of, you know, jumps forward 10 years to 9/11, is sort of crucial to sort of, you know, get a better understanding of, you know, of who he is, what was happening in his mind. I mean, you know, I'm not sure if I mentioned, Scott, but, you know, one of his greatest fears when he went to Afghanistan that he writes about in 1991 was, what will I do if there's no more jihad? Here I am devoting my life to jihad, but what will I do if there's no more jihad?
That was the problem they all had.
I'm sorry?
That was the problem they all had. They couldn't go home anymore. Their only job skills was how to blow up stuff.
Yeah, he was really worried about this. I mean, he was worried. He was, you know, fearful that you know, he won't have anything to fall back on. You fast forward about, you know, a decade, and this camp that he's closely associated with, Khaldin Camp, you know, was shut down by the Taliban to sort of try and bring everyone under, you know, Osama bin Laden's wing or under his umbrella. And you know, you get the sense that, you know, Zubeda is suddenly, his greatest fear is about to come true. What will I do if there's no more jihad? And
that's what they say every day in D.C. and Virginia, too.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, and I think that's part of what's so fascinating here is sort of bearing witness to his, you know, his desperation. And he shows up in Afghanistan in mid 2001, around May or June of 2001. He says he always loses track of time when he's ever in Afghanistan, but he has $50,000, and he says, you know, not much for an operation, you know, against the Jews and in against Israel. But I've talked with some of the brothers, and they'll support me, or they promise to support me later on. And you know, this is a real sort of change for him, at least the way he writes about it, because everything prior to that, it was really focused, so focused on, you know, these jihadist operations in Tajikistan and Bosnia, all the places where, you know, what he says, you know, infidels invading Muslim lands. But obviously, you know, with Israel, it's, you know, if you understand, if you can sort of relate to what he's talking about, you know, that was his own sort of you know, struggle as well, that he had no identity, and he talks about that. And, you know, this was sort of the same thing, getting people out of Palestine.
Mm-hmm. And then, so
what he calls the invaders out of Palestine, that is.
Mm-hmm. And then getting them out of there and just bring them to Afghanistan. But for what? I mean, bin Laden had a purpose for his army. What was the beta training these guys to do?
Well, he says that he was basically, you know, what they were training for is just in case anyone came and, you know, and invaded your land, you would be prepared. That's why he says that Khaldun was this public camp. You could come and go as you pleased. Mm-hmm. You could come for a weekend, you know, participate in some training. You'd have that under your belt, and maybe down the road, if you know, you're called for jihad or you want to be ready for jihad, you'd be prepared, Scott. Mm-hmm. And so that was what he was really focused on, as well as sort of hoping that there would be the creation of this, you know, Islamic state for right. Muslims.
Yeah, I mean, it did really become, ever since the Reagan years, and then all through the 90s still, it was just sort of a rite of passage for among some Muslim men to go to Afghanistan, Arabs to go to Afghanistan and go through the training camps. And, of course, people probably remember back in the, especially like the first Bush administration years, about how they would pretend that anyone who'd ever been to Afghanistan before or who had laid eyes on one of these camps were automatically all members of Al-Qaeda and working for bin Laden on his mission against us, when really you could have found people from towns all over the Middle East who went to those training camps sort of like a Eagle Scouts kind of a thing, or
exactly,
you know, being a private in the army and then being discharged kind of a thing. It didn't really make warriors and crazies and jihadists and anti-American terrorists out of all of them at all, but it made for a great talking point that it did. But so what
no,
you're telling me
I
is that that was Zubeda's roles. He just ran one of those training camps that Tom, Dick, and Harry would go and train in, but he was not really part of Al-Qaeda. So then, I mean, but he knew a lot, and you say that he helped them all celebrate on September 11th, right?
Yeah, no, he did. And, you know, and just to go on to your last point, that's why these diaries are really important. I mean, they really are an important historical document. And to really understand, you know, this world of jihad, I mean, you're getting it directly from a person who was there. And that's, you know, highly unusual. I mean, we don't have anything like this out there, Scott. There aren't any diaries floating around by a person of, you know, Zubeda's stature. But after 9/11, sure, yes, he says that, you know, after the news came out on the radio, lambs were slaughtered and juice and sweets were distributed to, you know, to celebrate, the attacks. And then the U.S. invaded, and his job was, you know, he says he was security. He was working security, but he also, you know, talked about, you know, various meetings that he participated with Mohammed Atef, who was, you know, killed in a drone strike, and he was the, you know, military leader at the time of Al-Qaeda. He said that, you know, the invasion had this unintended consequence of bringing all of these jihadist groups together from Pakistan and various tribes, you know, groups that never really got along with one another, but they all united, you know, against, you know, the U.S. after the, you know, the invasion.
And then when was he grabbed? The beginning of 02, right?
In March of 02. And so, you know, Taliban, you know,
actually,
regime.
Actually, wait a minute. Before we get to that, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was thinking of this question, but I forgot it. Before we get to the capture part, what do you know of his role in planning any at all of Al-Qaeda's stuff at the time, whatever? Because I thought, and maybe I'm just going from memory here, this is not in your piece, but I thought I had learned that so many of these bogus orange alerts that were going on mostly to just scare everybody into letting them invade Iraq back in 02 was what it was really about more than anything else. But that most of those were beaten out of this guy. That he was the one who said, oh yeah, a bank in New Jersey, a school in Texas, a bridge somewhere in Minnesota, or whatever nonsense, just made up nonsense to try to, you know, that they would use all the time to raise the level from yellow to orange and back again, that they must have known wasn't true at the time. But am I wrong about that? Or
no,
or
you're
he
not.
Was
I mean,
involved
they
in,
did.
Did he know anything about that stuff, or it was all just made up out of whole cloth, or what?
Well, you know, of course the U.S. government will say otherwise. And Ali Soufan, who is the FBI special agent that wrote a book called The Black Banners and interrogated him, you know, still maintains that that's accurate. But, you know, others just say there's, you know, this is not true. You know, he sent everyone on a wild goose chase because they were, you know, torturing him. And they were also torturing him for, you know, intelligence on Iraq's connection, you know, fantasy connection to al-Qaeda, in order to use that as more justification, you know, for the invasion. So
he never did implicate Iraq, though, did he? Or did he?
As far as I know, he didn't, but the emir of the training camp that he was closely associated with, that he writes about, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, did, and he was... You know, he was rendered to, I believe it was Egypt, and then eventually, you know, died in a jail in Libya. Supposedly, he, you know, committed suicide, Scott. And but it was everything that he provided that, you know, the U.S. used to show to claim that there was a connection.
I guess part of the premise of my question that I didn't really state very well, Jason, was that it seemed like, you know, they would say, okay, here's an example of a different sort, but kind of sort of the same, where Bush said, yeah, there's a threat to the Library Tower in Los Angeles, and how, yeah, what he means by that is once upon a time, a couple of guys sitting around talked about, well, maybe that could be one of the targets, but that... They were just taking it completely out of context. Sort of the same thing with Libby. It's like, yeah, we do have an al-Qaeda guy that implicated Saddam Hussein after we beat it out of him and told him, just say the name Saddam and we'll stop hurting you, you know?
Yes. Well, that's exactly what they did. I mean, so...
But my point being, though, so was Zubeda, when he was saying, yeah, bank in New Jersey, did they ever... Was he involved in discussions like that? Or he would have just been making things up out of nothing because he really wasn't that close to the guys who would have been talking about those sorts of things, is what I'm trying to ask you.
You know, I'm not entirely clear about what he was involved with regard to those specific, you know, so-called threats that... you know, that he provided intel on. But it's pretty clear in his diary, Scott, that, you know, he knew certain things that were taking place. With regard to 9/11, he doesn't write as if he knew 9/11 specifically, that, you know, that there was going to be this attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, but he says that he knew something big was coming. Everybody knew something big was coming. And, you know, with regard to other operations, he also suggests or seems to suggest that, you know, he's aware of what's happening. But it's to me, it's not clear that, you know, with regard to the Brooklyn Bridge, because there was a threat there and on Wall Street, that he was involved in any of that. But I'll just go, you know, again, go to Afghanistan. He talks about that he was in this meeting with the secretary to Mullah Omar, with Mohammed Atef, and they were discussing, you know, the strategy and security with regard to, you know, how to handle the U.S. So he was privy to some meetings, maybe not all of them, I don't know, but he definitely was in some areas.
And so, you know, certainly must have been a useful... target for intelligence, and, you know, I don't know if they have a case. What specific case are they trying to make against him in Guantanamo? I guess I was going to make the
question.
Case there,
you know,
before I interrupted myself, that maybe you could argue for the FBI interrogating him, if not CIA torturers, you know?
Well, I mean, yeah, and I think that, you know, the great question, you know, that you brought up about Guantanamo, it's entirely unclear, Scott. I mean, the government, the Justice Department says in court documents that the bulk of their case, for the most part, is contained in these 6 volumes of diaries, you know, that I obtained. But these diaries were written prior to, you know, the 9/11 attacks, and a little bit afterwards. So what would be their case? We've already seen how, you know, material support and conspiracy, you know, prior to 9/11 just, you know, was tossed out, that, you know, the D.C. Circuit said you can't make that retroactive because it wasn't a war crime. So we don't know what the case is against him. I think the fact of the matter is that he will never, ever be charged. I mean, he will probably die in Guantanamo or another, you know, detention facility. And, you know, that much seems pretty clear to me.
Now, so when the Americans invaded, he didn't fight at all? He just ran to Pakistan?
No, he was fighting. His fighting, you know, he doesn't write about, you know, I you know, was on the front lines here the way he does in the first volume and talks about, you know, how he was really on the front lines, you know, fighting in the Civil War. Here, it actually, you know, what his descriptions of fighting is more or less retreat and hiding. So, you know, he talks about security, but it's mostly, you know, just sort of, it seems to be protecting, you know, some of the senior al-Qaeda figures, and retreating, trying to get, you know, up into the mountains, trying to just eventually by foot, you know, make his way, you know, into Pakistan and help many of these, you know, old school Mujahideen jihadists escape.
So in a way, it sounds almost like they have a less of a case against him than they had against Cotter, which is, you know, Cotter at least was accused of defending himself.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if they're using the diaries, Scott, as the evidence, there's nothing in there where he's saying, I threw a grenade, you know, at a U.S. soldier. I shot this person. There's nothing there. The only thing that he talks about is his, you know, feelings about this was the right time to wage a war against the U.S., but he's also critical about what, you know, bin Laden did, because it's simply just a declaration of war. A real war would look much different. And then aside from that, it's let's help, you know, he's helping everyone escape. So that's pretty much it. I mean, it's fascinating because it really is action-packed. I mean, it's very visual, where he's writing about, you know, the drone strikes, the you know, hundreds of civilian deaths, and how they're trying to make their way out of Afghanistan.
And then I'm sorry, because I tried to ask you before, and then I interrupted you and me, or maybe it was the commercial's fault or something, but about his capture in Pakistan and then what happened to him after that, say, between there and Guantanamo.
Yes, well, he was, you know, after he was captured in Pakistan, he was in a, and by the way, his last diary entry is 8 days before he's captured, and he writes, nothing new. That's it.
Almost like, hey, watch this, you know, kind of just tempting fate.
Exactly, and you know, he's captured on March 28th, and, you know, he's shot 3 times, he's near death. A surgeon from Johns Hopkins is flown in to keep him alive, and he's whisked away to a CIA black site, believed to be in Thailand first. And not long after he's brought to the black site, you know, they have his diaries translated, and they build a psychological assessment on him, and they exploit his fears, and they subject him to, you know, to all these torture techniques.
what kind of torture techniques did they subject him to? Other than that, we talked about the drowning there.
Waterboarding, you know, wall slamming. You know, he was hung in stress positions. You know, they proposed putting him in a coffin-like box. One of the proposed techniques, Scott, was placing him in a box with an insect because he had a. They said he had a fear of bugs. Well, they discovered his fear of bugs from his diary because he writes about it. And so, see, that's part of that, you know, the exploitation that they knew what his fears were. You know, they went through this very carefully, and so that's, one of the proposed techniques.
Is it Jane Mayer's book that says that the reason that really the CIA got him from the FBI was because he really had told them most of what they wanted to know or was in the process, but the CIA wanted more, and they just thought if they could torture it out of him, he could come up with more, but he didn't really have what they were looking for, and so it was in their frustration, really, that they resorted to that. Or maybe before it got to the point of frustration, I guess. Dick Cheney was in a hurry.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I think that, you know, part of this is that we still don't know exactly what they were doing. I believe, I didn't report this, but I believe that they were, you know, this was their grand experiment. And I mean the experiment that, you know, if they were looking through the diary, Scott, you know, sure, they would have known that there was a level of importance there, but they also would have known that, you know, he wasn't this you know, number three in Al-Qaeda. And you already have the sort of disagreement between his level of importance between, you know, the FBI and the CIA. But, you know, using, having this, you know, these diaries to sort of exploit his fears and test out these methods that eventually were tweaked, were first used on him, and then tweaked in a way to sort of almost perfect them later on other, you know, prisoners. To me, that's, you know, the whole sort of like, oh, we need to get more intel. I think that's, you know, that's just a cover story.
Yeah, well, it was the same kind of thing with Khatani there at Guantanamo Bay, whereas, well, let's put this guy through the paces and see which combination of these may or may not add up to lowercase a abuse or whatever technical term that they were trying to stay just within.
Experiment. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I mean, you know, we see that to some extent, extent with, you know, again, how this was all sort of, you know, perfected later on when the torture memo was certainly, you know, changed a bit. With, you know, instead of, I'm just sort of throwing this out there, instead of pouring, you know, 12 pours, they would do 14, and they based that off of the way Zubeda responded. So, but look, here we are 12 years after 9/11, and we're still learning about, you know, what was happening, and this is a person whose voice we have never, ever heard from. We've never heard his voice. So the fact that we have this opportunity now, you know, to hear directly, to hear his voice directly, and, you know, people take the time to actually read the source documents, you know, I think that it's, you know, again, it's just an important part of history. And, you know, people will draw their own conclusions about, you know, what they feel and what they think. But I think it sort of underscores how, you know, the narrative that the U.S. put out is not exactly the right narrative.
Right. And now, you know, I'd hate to leave people with a false impression that Guantanamo is full of a bunch of guys who even had ever met Bin Laden or heard of him necessarily, which most of those people, even still most of them, have nothing to do with. You know, the people who were formerly held by the CIA at their secret prisons and now serve as sort of the window dressing on what is really a warehouse for people who have already been cleared for release. And what's funny to me is, especially the way you put it about how many years ago this was now, that we're still going on with even the Democrats, as Obama put it, that, you know, some of these people, if they're acquitted, we'll still hold them. And some of them, we won't even give them military trials on this made-up, almost ad hoc basis of Military Commission Act courts because, you know, maybe we don't have anything against them. And so we don't want to risk that they'll be acquitted and then that we'll have to hold them indefinitely anyway. And so we'll just not even give them trials at all. And it seems like, you know, hey, this is America where it's pretty easy that, I mean, it's not like it's you're going to get a fair trial anyway, but it seems like you could just indict these guys on some charges and convict them or let them go because that's just the way we do these things. And none of this implies any mercy for this guy necessarily if the government has the evidence that says he's the number three guy in Al-Qaeda somewhere other than these diaries and let's see it. But that's what trials are for.
Exactly.
But the fact that you would just sit here and tell me, and I know that you mean it, and I know that you're probably right, that no, this guy will die of old age at the lawless American black hole prison in communist Cuba is just amazing. Like, how could that possibly be? He's still only like 40-something, this guy, right?
Yeah, no, he is, but, you know.
I mean, no, we gotta knock this off. It's crazy. Indict him. How hard could it possibly be to convict this guy in federal court when they can convict anyone of anything in federal court? Accuse him of mail fraud or something and just tax
well,
evasion.
Mail fraud would probably be easier, but Scott, you know, keep in mind that the National Defense Authorization Act, you know, for 2014 is coming up for, you know, debate again. And there are numerous provisions in there with regard to Guantanamo, and you know, one of the most important ones is that the Senate, or rather this legislation, is directing, you know, the Department of Defense and the State Department, they want to be sure that Yemen is creating its own Guantanamo for any sort of transfer of prisoners. So they want full reports on what Yemen is doing to detain, prosecute, and even rehabilitate, you know, Yemeni prisoners. So, you know, we're looking to sort of continue the cycle, even with the, you know, as we transfer them. So, I mean, this is, look, we've been going through this every year when this legislation is renewed, and, you know, we hear the same thing from Obama. My hands are tied. So, you know, here we are, probably, you know, hear that same narrative all over again. So on paper, or rather what, you know, what you're saying is true. How hard can it be? But nobody seems to be willing to sort of, you know, step up and try and do that.
Yep. All right. Well, we're already over time. We got to leave it here and cut it off and all that. But thanks very much for your time. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
All right, everybody. Check out this great journalism at america.aljazeera.com. One, exclusive, Abu Zubaydah's journey from student to Mujahideen. And then two, Zubaydah Diaries shed new light on Twin Towers and links to bin Laden. And then along with that is the secret diary of Abu Zubaydah. So far, they've only published, I believe, the first volume, but the rest are coming up. So check out this awesome scoop at America.aljazeera.com, the great Jason Leopold, and thanks for listening.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016, FDR, no longer the worst president in American history, the National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952, and USA. Sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
Hey, all, Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.